Hello, everyone listening. It is me, John Papagiorgio, the host of Papa's Basement. I'm here today again with my friend and improv teacher from around D.C., Sean Westfall. So it's not exactly a Papa's Basement. It is because we're in the studio. I'm playing the intro song. That makes it right there. I could put this at the beginning of a copy of Slippery When Wet, and I own Bon Jovi. That's
you need to work
works.
On your branding here, okay?
Oh, just whatever, man. Whatever. You know what? Here's my branding. 10 years that went nowhere. Papa's Basement. There's my fucking brand in a nutshell. But yeah, I just wanted to have Sean in, and we're trying to do a show, I guess, once a month. You're the people in your life went apes bananas, pardon my profanity, but they went nuts for the last thing we did together where we just kind of recorded at your house. And
yeah, I got a lot of responses. I don't know if they necessarily went nuts. Perhaps they were just being kind. And
all right, Mr. Branding.
Perhaps they were being nice and you know, to an old man, giving him, oh, that was such a good podcast. You look at the old man doing the podcast.
It's like a record, a radio, this podcast. Is that how it functions, Mr. Westfall? So, yeah, I figure we'd do another. I just enjoy sitting around with you.
Right back at you.
Talking about the darker shit in life. Because otherwise, like right now, I'm doing the show with Alex Wasdahl and Travis Dorward. And they're both like 23.
Yeah, they don't know what the hell's going on.
I mean, they both like still like life.
Yeah, I know.
It's terrifying.
Just wait, kids.
No one needs that business. So I wanted to have you in and we could just talk about the darker stuff.
Sure.
And talk about, you know, dreams not so much deferred as just dreams dead.
Right.
And just do that for 30 minutes. And then
now, if that isn't branding, I don't know what called, is.
Yeah, the dream that dead. Died. Yeah, dreams dead. It's also the name of my podcast. Death metal act. Yeah. But we had a couple. The big thing I wanted to come in with this week in terms of depressing stories to get us down our dark fucking passage.
Right.
Was the suicide of Anthony Bourdain.
Right, which followed closely upon the suicide of Kate Spade as well. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I actually knew who that was because my ex had a Kate Spade bag, mm-hmm. So I saw that insignia damn time.
My wife has like two or three of them, I think, yeah.
You know, maybe if she had four or five, she wouldn't have done it.
Exactly.
How about that shit?
Right.
Yeah. So Kate Spade, that's right. No, Kate Spade died, and I think everyone... Anthony Bourdain was a bit easier to kind of analyze and sit back, think about that, because Kate Spade's death, everyone just walked away being like, oh, the Spades from the David Spade family?
Right.
I didn't know that. No one knew that. You as a comedy man might have known that.
I did, yeah.
Fuck, wow, good for you, man.
Yeah.
Literally everyone else I know was just like, really? David's brother?
Yep.
There aren't any other Spades in America?
That's just...
Yeah, and then I'm... Depending on the party, would make an inappropriate racial joke in
relation
to that.
Sure,
and then,
course.
Yeah.
Right.
So Kate took her own life, and then Anthony Bourdain killed himself.
Right.
I will let you go down that path and wax on that one for a bit, but I just wanted to say, I don't know how much of the show you listen to, but one of the few things that I do, like a recurring bit, God forbid it be on air, again, any sort of branding,
right.
Any sort of continuity, but off air... I get off on telling my mom that a celeb has died before she knows about it.
So tell me why you get off on that.
I don't know why. Like, it's pure sadism, I guess. Like,
there's also people who seem to be like the first to want to like post that on like social media.
Oh, there's
I understand it, but at the same time, I want to go, you know. My point is like people like share that information on Facebook, you know, and great, terrific, but it's not like they're not one or two posts in front of CNN breaking that thing or the New York Times sort of breaking that thing, right?
People live for that. They like to get off on being like the town crier.
Yeah, right? yeah.
But especially the graphic violence stuff.
Right. Right.
I mean, occasionally you'll have a friend who's just like, there's a hydrant broken on 14th and H. You're like, All right. Thanks, buddy, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a ton of people who, I believe, love to post bad news and then also try to in any way insinuate themselves into it.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not calling out anyone by name because I can't think of anyone by name. My memory's shit.
Right.
But a couple weeks ago, Dylan Meyer, a D.C. area comedian, died.
I heard that, yeah.
And literally anyone I've ever, out of the 10 open mics I've ever done, because I'm trying hard at stand-up.
Right.
anyone I ever knew like posted something about like, you know what, I hung out with Dylan and I don't want to say anything, but after he saw my set, he held me up like baby Simba.
Right.
And it was just like, you are the next Louis C.K. minus the jerk in it shit.
Right, right, right.
So with Bourdain, I, for whatever reason, I don't want to announce to the world. I just enjoy seeing my mom's reactions because it's funny to me to see anyone moved by the death of someone kind of outside their immediate circle.
Right.
Maybe because I'm just numb as shit to it. Like,
well, I mean, to be honest and to be intellectually honest, I used to post a lot of that stuff.
Really?
I want to say I stopped about 4 or 5 years ago, but they were mostly like the obituaries that I would share, again, off the New York Times, would primarily be sort of artists and writers. I guess, you know, one of the things I get frustrated by our social media culture is that we are, you know, still even on social media enamored by you know, the celebrities that seem to compromise a lot of that airtime. And so, you know, mine would always be writers and poets and people who were a bit more obscure.
Yeah.
And not out of like pretension. My understanding of culture at large, and it's, you know, it's there, you have your own obviously. But it's that there is no sort of high culture or there's no low culture without high culture. And there is no high culture and low culture without middlebrow culture. And I think sometimes we get too focused on the popular culture and the low culture.
Our needle has gone far in that direction right now.
Yeah, and I think that was sort of my way of saying, you know, there are great writers. There, you know, giants are in our midst. And sometimes, you know, the publicist arm behind the people who are compromising a lot of our popular culture takes up a lot of the airspace, and you don't really understand, you know, like who the people were who the you know, what's that famous Isaac Newton quote that he, you know, he came up with the three laws of motion by standing on the shoulders of giants.
Yes.
Right. And, you know, we still are standing on the shoulders of giants still walk among us if you just simply know where to look for them.
The NBA.
Like for instance, I mean, most recently I posted something about the death of Tom Wolfe.
That literally the only author I could pull.
Right.
I was going to say on Snapchat, you had the death of Tom Wolfe, not so much traction. Death of Lil Peep.
Right.
Whole bunch of mourning.
Yeah, Tom Wolfe's not a Snapchat guy. I don't understand that. Right. Exactly. Right. But I mean, the you know, what I did was I sort of grabbed this huge long quote from his book, The Right Stuff, and just instead of saying, I love Tom Wolfe, I go, this, you know, insinuating this is one of the reasons why he is so and was so great. And just the nature of that prose style. And that's sort of also my preference too. I just gravitate towards good writers. I always have, you know, even when I was younger. So, yeah.
So when you like my Facebook statuses, then?
That means that I think that's brilliant prose style, expertly executed.
My day is made.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just wanted to say real fast that I'm going to retire this bit of telling my mom.
Why? Why are you going to do that?
Because I hit it out of the park on this one with Anthony Bourdain.
Oh, really?
Like the timing and the situation and everything. And I felt so bad. Like, this is the first time I've done this for years. And people are like, you're a piece of shit. I'm like, yeah, but it's funny.
Right.
And this is the first time I was like, no, I'm just a piece of shit. So, you know, I live with my mom because I'm crushing it.
Right.
Hashtag
you crushing it.
Crushing it.
Gary Vaynerchuk. Vaynerchuk crushing it.
I had learned he had passed around like 7 a.m. and my mom kind of keeps more vampiric hours.
Right.
So just like for 2 hours. She's just asleep still. I'm like, ba-da-ba-ba-ba, you know, just like, just tapping.
Just waiting to break
yeah,
the news.
Just waiting. And she gets up and goes to the restroom, and she's doing the morning urination thing that all of we humans enjoy. And I just kind of threw the door. I'm like, hey, Mom, Anthony Bourdain died. And I just hear her like both urinating and sobbing all of a sudden. And that was kind of Then she just started saying, "Why? Why did you tell me this?" And I was like, "She's right. God damn it, she's right."
By the way, urinating and sobbing isn't something we've all done. Let's face it, we've all done that.
There's just something sadder about a woman who has to sit for it, though.
Yeah, that's true. That's
like
true.
A guy, you're doing it against a tree, and you're thinking about that two-timing bitch.
Yeah, you have your arm up against the wall of the urinal, and you're
John, are you crying? No! Yeah. Give me another. Yeah. But yeah, this was just morning pee.
Right.
No booze in the mix there.
Right.
And that's all I had to say for the rest of the episode. And this is all you now.
Cool. So I'm taking it from here.
Yeah.
Tell me why you're bringing up the Anthony Bourdain.
Well, bringing up Anthony Bourdain because he seemed like an intellectual and a traveler.
Right.
And he also had grayish hair like you.
Thanks.
And tattoos crushing like you.
It. Yeah. Trademark Gary Vaynerchuk.
And I figured if I had to pull like a figure out of somewhat pop culture out of my ass that you'd really be into, first it would be like Khloe Kardashian, but then it'd be Anthony Bourdain.
Yeah.
And so I figured you could, and we've also talked about struggles with depression on this show.
Right.
I figured, because I've got a little something to add to the fire once you've done your thing, but I figure you could relate to that.
Yeah, and
what happened?
And you know, to go back to posting things on social media about, you know, celebrities who have died. I posted something on Facebook and never mentioned Anthony. Well, it did mention Anthony Bourdain by name. No, it didn't. I apologize. This particular post did not. But it talked about, you know, I guess it was in response to people doing something similar or having reactions whereby they said, "Why?" And my reaction was, you know, the question for me was never why. It was always why not. And it has to do with a space in which, you know, obviously a not very healthy one, but I'm trying to think of a good metaphor, and there are no metaphors to do justice to what this is like. People have talked about holes or you know, black clouds or, you know, whatever dark imagery you want to sort of think. For me, and this is sort of reason I posted this, you find yourself in this unhealthy position where everything seems so lost. You seem so lost, and you seem sort of like in this miasma where there's no positive experiences happen, or even if there are positive experiences, you're cherry picking the ones that aren't, and you're using this to create a narrative whereby you are completely, utterly helpless, worthless. Everything you do is an exercise in futility, and there's no way out. And this has absolutely nothing to do with the world is operating. In fact, it might even be it probably is a self-indulgent way of thinking about circumstances, because you're not being more outwardly focused. You're focusing inwardly, which is a very bad place to be. And you begin to start thinking about this. I've had moments since this has happened over the past 18 years. But 18 years ago, I spent a good year in this space where I was working a horrible job. Things weren't going well for me relationship-wise. My marriage was ending. I was in a really bad place. And I would drive home every day from where I worked, onto George Washington Parkway, and I at the time I was living in an apartment in Arlington. I would drive onto George Washington Parkway, and I would think, all I have to do is keep driving to a pawn shop or a Walmart, buy a gun, and just go blow a tunnel through my head. And I literally would think that every single day. And I don't know what it was that would stop me from thinking like that. Perhaps it was the music, or perhaps something would sort of snap me out of it. But you initially start thinking about how you're going to do it, right? Yeah, and I said this in my post. You start noticing, you know, there are the pawn shops in your area that say, "We sell guns," right? you start looking around at, like right now, we're in a studio, and I've already noticed that you have like pipes hanging from the top of the studio. And
trust me, they can't support body weight. Well, I've tried.
That's my point. Okay. Like you start going, huh, you know what you could, and this is, you know, back then I would think, I could get a rope and, you know, you could make a new, and you go, okay, yeah. And with that, and you'd look at that stool in the corner and you go, would that support that?
You're like a
yeah.
death MacGyver.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you start thinking about it. And then because this, and I sort of said this in the post, the synaptic path is clear. You know, when things happen, you know, or when you pin your hopes on something to help get you out of it and it doesn't work, mm-hmm. you go swifter to those paths. And you know, the images become more vivid, and you know, the repercussions or even the consequences become more, you know, you start worrying less about that and just the mechanics of how you would do it. And it really, of course, it obviously isn't a very healthy place to be, and I'm not really sure how I got out of it. Mm-hmm. This is another thing too. I mean, I'm a working class kid. I'm a shit kicker from Southern Indiana.
That's a job out there.
It pays so well, but I mean, one of the things that working class people sort of assume is that, you know, you take care of your own problems. You don't share your own problems, and you take care of your own problems.
Yeah.
So, and we're talking to, you know, I was in my mid 30s and had been around the world when I was, you know, when I was going through this. And it still would have never occurred to me to go talk to a professional, to go talk to a therapist, because we take care of our, we don't, that's a luxury that rich people, that's a self-indulgent luxury that rich people do. Working class people don't do that. We don't ever fucking do. There's a line in, what's that Martin Scorsese movie, Jack Nicholson, Matt Damon,
Departed,
right? There's a line that Matt Damon's character says in The Departed that has really resonated with me. Where he's, you know, he's having that sort of like tense relationship with that the female character. I can't remember her name.
Finnish name.
Yeah. But he says something like, you know, hey, he says, I'm Irish. You know me, I'm Irish. I'll deal with shit being fucked up for the rest of my life, right? and again, just replace the word Irish with lower middle class or lower class, and that was my attitude. That so it wasn't therapy that did it, and I think that that's why I spent so long in that space. And again, taking mind drugs, taking antidepressant meds would have never occurred to me. I would have never gone to the therapist required to prescribe them, or B, even taken them. And even though at that time I was probably desperately in need of them, mm-hmm. really. Like I spent way too fucking long in that space, I don't even know how I got out. I really have no idea how I got out. It just this sort of slow. Ways in which my synaptic paths changed, and I don't remember making a conscious decision to start eschewing those thoughts, but I got out of it eventually. I remember I'd started teaching at the DC Improv, and it was in like my second or third year of teaching, and I think that's probably what helped, was that I actually sort of began actively looking for things to occupy my time. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as any sort of therapist will tell you, this your head is enemy territory. You shouldn't spend too much time up there. And that was another thing I was doing, was spending way too much time up there. And so I began being more social and spending time and teaching improv. I was teaching like 3 or 4 classes a week. And I decided to throw myself a 40th birthday party. I'd only been in D.C. for 4 or 5 years by that time. But because of the classes, I sort of made a lot of connections. And I basically invited anyone who wanted to show up to my 40th birthday party. And back then we were doing Evites. And this friend of mine who knew from another part of my life who was in the D.C. area took a look at the Evite and he says, why are you inviting like, you know, 250 people to your 40th birthday party? And my answer was, because I can.
Yeah.
Because
I want to get some, damn it.
No, well, they're sure, of course.
Yes.
But also because, you know, 5 years ago, you know, 4 years prior, sorry, I didn't know anybody, and I was this close, you know, yeah, inches away from pulling the fucking trigger.
No, even loose acquaintances. Why the fuck not?
Why not? Because I, at the very least, you know, it's those people who sort of helped me get out of it. It was that activity that sort of helped me get out of it.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting that your depression took such a focused, I guess, like actually eyeballing the end.
Oh, God. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I, for whatever reason, I always test positive for, I guess, more what they call dysthymia or whatever.
I don't even know. Tell me what that is.
That is like constant low to moderate depression.
Uh-huh.
I will get into this later, but I took a test recently where they're like, you tested positive for 2 out of 4 suicidal markers.
So there are 4 suicidal markers?
They didn't. Yeah, I didn't read my results.
They didn't. What are they?
I think depression is one.
Right.
And the second is isolation. Those were the two that I had. Yep. That I'm not really all that networked and that I am just generally depressed. For me, what clicks when it comes to the Anthony Bourdain stuff, not so much the actual suicide, but just being numb to life overall and just not feeling joy. Like my version of depression is I can do these great things, but overall I'm just numb to everything. Like I don't feel... This sounds weird, but I don't really feel joy all that much.
Yeah.
Like, even when good stuff happens, like, I can feel pain somewhat acutely, but I'm kind of numb to that, too.
Right.
Like, I'm more just numb in general. Like, I can only kind of feel, like, visceral stuff. Like, oh, I'm laughing, so I guess I must be happy. And that's it. Like, pretty much, I've explained why I just look at Netflix and porn. You know, like...
Is it an attitude of is the reason you don't experience joy or reticent to experience joy because you know that's going to pass and it's going to go back?
Probably.
Or it's, you know, that this is great, but shit's going to go back to being, you know, the normative state of being awful.
Yes.
Or not awful.
If you let yourself experience the high, then you have to experience the low.
Right.
I think for me, I just am very much at this kind of feelingless state. And especially when it comes to, I mean, it's bad for the romantic life because I really don't let anyone make me particularly happy.
Right.
Because I'm like, they're going to go eventually. And then when they do, I'm like, well, like I'll still get messed up by it, but I could have been more messed up.
Right.
So I can see going through that numbness for years on end and eventually just being like, this is really boring at this point. Like I'm very done with this.
If
this is all there is, then let's just wind it up. But yeah, I've never made plans as of yet. Like if the remainder of my family passed away,
mm-hmm.
I would probably do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You would probably make plans?
Yeah.
Or you would follow through on the plans?
I'd like to think I'm not a quitter, so I'd like to think I'm not all talk. At that point I could see myself, because pretty much a lot of what would keep me around is just guilt of like, I don't want to have my mom and brother pay for, you know,
right,
a couple of sweet Latina maids to scrub my brains out of whatever.
Right.
You know, so I don't do it. And I like to think in theory things could get better.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm positive on that note. I just don't build concretely toward that all that much.
Yeah.
And when I do change things, that's the really bad part, is I don't really feel the good that comes with it. So I slip back into like, I'm just going to watch 10 hours of Netflix.
So, I mean, and you are obviously under the care of a therapist right now, right?
I am, yeah. I'm back to that.
Like I said, you are obviously and clearly under the care of a therapist.
Yeah, I've been back to it for 3 months. It's funny that we've had this talk before about being like upper, lower, middle, as the Simpsons call themselves.
Right.
I'm the same background. You know, my dad was like literally grew up in the Greek or the German occupation of Crete. Like, you know, 6th through 9th grade was just him living in a cave.
Right.
Being like, oh, science today. You can eat snails and not die. Yay. So he came over here, worked as a locksmith and all that crap. So for whatever reason, though, despite that background, I did get into therapy because I had like bougie friends through my gifted and talented background.
Right.
And so there's like one kid who was just like deep into like getting Prozac and Dexedrine from a shrink at like 8th grade. And I was like, I'm messed up. I kind of want that. And so I've been in and out of therapy for years, like where I'll go like 2 years without at this point, 3 years, then I'll come back, do 6 weeks. Bullshit.
Right.
I rarely have success with it. I kind of like my current therapist well enough. I don't know.
So is there such a thing as success with therapy? Meaning that, you know, so fast forward my own experience to about 8 years ago mm-hmm. when I started having those visions again.
Yeah.
And again, following an on again, off again, 3 year relationship that was going, that went south, I started having that. And I remembered, of course, how awful that space was, and I decided to do something about it, and I sought out a therapist. But, and I was for the very first time. And of course, you know, when you go seek therapy for the very first time, you go, tell me what I should do. What should I do? What should I do? And of course, the therapist won't tell you what to do, but they will come and make you sort of like talk about it. You know,
yeah,
that's interesting. Let's talk about that. What about that? You know, and of course, what you discover is, and what I discovered, despite my impatience for the therapist to tell me what to do, what cognitive thing.
That's what I want. Yeah.
Right. You know, talking about it is just as valuable and perhaps even more worthwhile of a process than having them tell you what to do. The simple act of talking about it got me through those feelings and that dynamic again, which is what, you know, that's what I discovered. That's the discovery that I made for the first time going into therapy when I was in my mid 40s. First time I set foot in a therapist's office, I was 44, and I spent a year there. And like you, I was like, or I'm assuming, you know, maybe you weren't, but I was like, no, this is great, but tell me what I should do. And, well, you know, come back next week, and we'll talk about it, you know. She kept putting off that. But, of course, what she understood perhaps better than I did, well, obviously better than I did, was that it's just a process. You just talk it through. You just keep talking and talking. And again, and as a friend of mine pointed out, it's like, look, what better? Someone has to listen to you. You're paying her to listen to you.
Yeah.
So, and you know, even if nobody else in the world wants to hear you whine about, you know, the shitty relationship you had with your parents, she does. Or, you know, in case of his therapist, he does, you know. So that process is valuable in and of itself. At least I learned that.
I just want to say you're constantly trying to keep your famous friends on the down low.
Right.
That friend you just mentioned, Dolph Lundgren.
That's exactly who it was. I didn't want to say it, but yes, my friend Dolph Lundgren.
On the set of The Punisher, his Punisher film. I know exactly what you're saying, though. Like, I go to therapy,
right,
and I'll kind of ask her, like, well, what do you think? She's like, well, you're the one who's here to talk. I'm like, I can talk to a goddamn wall.
Right.
Like, I'm here to hear answers come out of your answer hole.
Right.
But I'm with you.
By the way, that's a highly technical term, answer hole.
Your answer hole.
If you have to go through years of college to be able to call yourself someone with an answer hole.
No, when I drive through Burger King, and I'm like, make the order come out of the answer hole. All right, chicken fries, we're good. So I know what you're saying, and I'm the same way. I'll go to therapy, and I want to walk out like Mary Tyler Moore type shit. Throw right. my hat in the air.
We
like,
can turn the world on with
we
a
got
smile.
This. And I want to go there really. My logic was if I can get one thing in check,
right,
it would be like fixing my eating, getting in better shape. And I'd also like to get focused more so when it comes to what I've said is my dream for going on 15 years now, comedy stuff.
Right.
I pretty much want to become like white Terry Crews
right.
with the hair. Like cool. He's got it.
You know, that's
he's,
right.
He's got abs and he's got a good gig.
Right.
And that hasn't happened so far, but I'll let you know when it does
Please
happen.
Please do.
I'm going to do the next episode.
I'll be
Blackface.
Dropping your name. My friend, by the way, by which I mean
yeah,
Big Papa,
exactly.
John Papa Giorgio.
On the set of The Punisher. So... Yeah, the Anthony Bourdain thing in general, did that, you're saying any celeb suicide, you're kind of like, well, duh, no fucking shit, they'll kill themselves. But did he in particular mean anything to you? Or?
Only in the sense that he was one of the people who helped revitalize, and this is a weird geeky thing with me,
mm-hmm.
a literary sort of niche with me. Do you seriously want to talk about this?
Because what the hell?
I could bore the shit out
Do
of you.
Do you know what I have to offer regarding Anthony Bourdain? There was a deli called the Song Kwe Deli over
right.
in Eden Center, and he went there one time maybe to take a shit and wash his hands, and they had a picture of like him with the owners on the wall.
Right.
And so I'd sit there eating my stinky tofu and garbage plant sandwich and just look at Anthony Bourdain every time. Like, oh, I'm eating where greatness was. Look at me. That's it. That's my Anthony Bourdain story.
Vicarious greatness.
Yeah.
Thing, right.
Deli's long since gone.
What I loved about Anthony Bourdain was, you know, through his book and his subsequent series, he revitalized, and it was sort of already gaining momentum, but he sort of helped push travel to the forefront, and not the sort of like the kind of chirpy advertising bullshit you see on Travel Channel. Hey, have you been to Bora Bora? Here's the cool thing to do at Bora Bora. And there's the, you know, the product shot of, you know, two gorgeous people, both, you know, male and a female in, you know, obviously great shape, lounging on a beach in Bora Bora with a, you know, a pink martini or whatever, you know, exotic drink they have in their hand, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, so
a Bora Bora.
Yeah, yeah, the Travel Channel should more accurately be called the Tourism Channel, because all it is, it's the stuff that timeshare condos and exotic locations would push out, try to get you to take a look at in order to invest.
It's not like fly here and be a child soldier.
All it is that stuff on steroids. Okay. That's all it really is. Whereas Bourdain would actively seek out obscure places, places to eat. Like, you know, when he went to, you know, the locations he went to, he didn't seek out the 4-star restaurants.
Yeah.
And, you know, he would go to the hole in the wall places, and, you know, and I'm not saying that he would, you know, he would actively try to democratize food, mm-hmm. or actively try to egalitarianize it, if that's a word, and say, look, this hole in the wall place is just as good as this place.
Yeah.
But what he would do is he would pay close attention to the culture there and how the culture informed the cuisine, and highlight that and profile, you know, the people behind that, as opposed to simply saying, you know, come here, come to, I lived in Hawaii. I lived on the island of Oahu. And of course, you know, whenever you think about the island of Oahu, you think about, you know, the beaches of Waikiki and the big huge resorts that are there, the Outrigger Canoe Club and Duke Hanamoka's place.
You're just making shit up now.
I literally those places do not exist. I just made them up. But if you live there, you sort of get to understand and stay away from those obviously tourist places that are on Oahu. You find out where the good stuff is, and you find out a lot about the local native Hawaiian culture and the various other cultures that are there in Hawaii. I mean, it's a gathering place for the Pacific Rim. There are, you know, there are Japanese Americans, Chinese Americans, Korean Americans, Laotians, Laotian American, Filipino Americans, huge, you know, swaths of culture. So, and what you discovered was you couldn't find that stuff out if you stayed exclusively in the sort of, let's call it what it was, a gated tourist community right there on Waikiki. And that's what I loved about him, what he would actually sort of seek out those places. He would travel. He would literally travel. And which is a strange thing to say. Of course, he'd have to literally travel. But I mean, he would travel in the sense, this is what I mean by that. He would travel in the sense, one of my favorite books is a book called Abroad by a guy named Paul Fussell. One of my favorite critics, one of my favorite writers, debarred by nature from not writing anything worth reading. Every word he wrote is just amazing. And he wrote this book called Abroad, which is a survey of the travel memoirs of the 1930s, primarily by British writers. Norman Douglas, Evelyn Waugh, who else am I thinking of? Robert Byron. I know these names are obscure, and there's a reason for that, because what they did was they started traveling to certain parts of the world where, you know, the infrastructure for travel and tourism wasn't there. So it was a bit of a tribunal to get to these places, you know, everything from ships to canoes to places, and not in the sort of outdoorsy sense. There are places that have since become very touristy that when they weren't, you know, touristy, they were places you traveled to. And again, implicit in the word travel was it's hard to get there. You aren't anesthetized on a cruise ship to get to certain places. It took, you know, wit. It took guts. It took fortitude. It took, you know, physical and emotional
Hannibal
strength.
Through the Alps type shit.
Exactly. Right. To get to these places, because once you got to these places, there were places worth seeing. Seeing with eyes that aren't being mediated by some sort of, you know, touristy place to set you up there.
Creed wrote a song about that called With Eyes Wide Open.
And that was where I was going next. And thank you for beating me there.
You're reeling me.
I suppose the most recent example is a guy named by the name of Bruce Chatwin, who died in like 1980, wrote a book called In Patagonia. And of course, Patagonia now is a brand, right? But before Patagonia was a brand, it was.
I was going to say, is this a book about wearing a jacket?
It walks you through how to put on a jacket and how to zip it up. It's 340 pages. Good luck with it.
Meticulous. Right?
But no, I mean, he went to Patagonia when, you know, which is the tip of the bottom of South America, when no one would go there. And it was actually hard to get there, and wrote this brilliant, gorgeous travel memoir. So what I loved about Bourdain, and again, that's a long-winded way of getting back to this. What I loved about Bourdain was he was harking back, or at least trying to resuscitate as best he could, this idea, this notion of travel being this thing that you weren't, you know, anesthetized against. Or in Americans, when we travel in American packs, and we wonder why other people don't speak English. Well, half the fun or half the cool stuff about travel is going to places where no one speaks fucking English. Good luck. And making your way that way. He has a quote in the book which basically says, I posted this recently, so I might bowdlerize this, but it's travel takes you to places, tourism takes you to pseudo places. And that's sort of what I loved about Bourdain, was he was trying to hark back to this idea of travel as a uniquely human endeavor that required planning, it required intelligence, it required wit, it required you to be present. It wasn't something that you experienced through on a tour bus or on a cruise ship. It was something that you took great effort to get there. So again, very long-winded. I apologize.
You
might want to put a trigger back in, or a note.
Poor choice of words.
Yeah, thank you. You might want to put something in this blog saying, hey, we're going to talk about like boring travel shit. Fast forward to minute, 35 to get past.
I do a great farting Jimmy Stewart.
That's right. Wow. My Jozo. God. Papa Giorgio. What?
No, it's, I just, the only thing I have to add to that is there's this funny, to me, paradox with white folks in general,
right?
Where you do want to get to these places where you just don't see other white people,
right?
Like, this is authentic, and to me, it extends even to like, again, Eden Center. I'll go to certain shops, and if I just see like one other white dipshit with the glasses and beard like me, like, how dare you de-authenticate my fucking soup?
What are you doing here?
This is mine.
Right.
Yeah, that's all I had. Nothing.
Huh?
Nothing.
Cool.
Trigger. So Bourdain, and he is kind of tragically gone. And the only other thing that stuck out to me was, who is it? I saw on Rose McGowan did some video, I guess, mourning for Asia Argento, his possibly not girlfriend at the time of his passing, possibly kind of helped. She was sobbing her guts out, which is an entire genre of social media posting that I hate, where you're just so goddamn moved that you're just bawling your eyes out and can barely get it out. And I'm like, could it be more about you? Come on. Fucking get it together. Yeah. You know, hold up a sign with the suicide hotline number.
You know, there is something to be said for decorum. So Prince Harry and Meghan Markle got married, of course, as we all know, as the world knew, about a month ago, right?
In that range, yeah.
And of course, you know, one of the things that kept getting commented on by both, you know, commentators in Britain and I didn't watch it.
Her tits real?
Well, yes, of course. But by both commentators in Britain and commentators here in America was how this sort of ushers in a new style for the royal family, the royal house, and how, you know, the queen is very staid and conservative and is not used to emoting and things like that. And sure, and God knows, you know, every single institution needs updating every now and then. But there is something to be said for, and I'm surprised this is actually coming from me, emotional restraint. You know, not the sort of wringing of your hands when it comes to, you know.
Don't act like a damn Italian.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, there's something to be said for I don't know where I'm going with this, but there's something to be said for.
I'm with you. Like
decorum, time and place.
If you're not
time
a sociopath,
right.
you're feeling the same emotions everyone else is.
Right,
like, you don't
right.
have to be bawling your eyes out. I
right.
mean, like, I am a fan of the British stiff upper lip.
Right.
You know, there's something to be said for that.
Right.
This was, again, I'm just telling stories that make me sound horrible. But when I was a little child, I was at a funeral home in a parking lot, and it was, I think, like a Greek funeral home. So it's
right.
just, you know, people losing their shit.
Right.
And some guy was in the parking lot just wailing his guts out.
Right.
And as a kid, like, after just hearing the crying for like 60 seconds straight, I just screamed out the car window, shut up.
Right.
I was a real empath back then. I remember getting a swift one across the face for it.
Well, funerals are different. Like, you know, I mean, that's where you're supposed to do that, you know. Maybe not to the extent that that person was, but I mean, I don't know what his loss was, his or her loss was.
Yeah.
I don't want to joke. But, I mean, the idea that this should take place, you know, in social media, you know, where you're actively, you're consciously turning on a, or pressing a button to then emote, you know, and,
like
and share that with, that seems a little, you know, different. You know, this happened not in public. It was at a you know, at an occasion for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you were being kind of a dick.
Oh, yeah. I was six and a twat back then.
but, you know, it just seems... And again, and you're talking to a guy who's, if you look at my own social media history, I'm probably guilty of some of the things I'm indicting myself for. So I certainly don't want to.
I just know you for a ton of like free sunglasses posts on Facebook. That's...
Well, then my work here is done.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel every time you're on Facebook, you will post something about these deaths, but it's at least like, it's a more intellectual angle than the average person.
Yeah.
I'll give you that, goddammit.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks.
Most people are simply really quick to say how they want to connect themselves to it, and then we'll post like a fucking clip, like
right,
Anthony
right.
Bourdain or something. You know, it's
right.
like, oh, this is when he found a tapeworm in his dick.
From, right.
Yeah, you know, going up the Mekong Delta. But you'll at least have something. So you contribute to it. I think you try to make your Facebook a headier space and that, you know, the
yeah,
walls.
I mean,
it's cool. You're smart. I you got a pass.
I don't know. I think sometimes I think it comes from an authentic place.
It does.
I mean, these are the things I'm passionate about, you know, and I've been taxed with pretension, in the past. Like a good friend says, you know, God, you always sound so pretentious. And I go, what? Because I'm interested in this stuff? I think the things that frustrate me is like, you know, I never go, hey, asshole, what's your connection to the Washington Capitals?
Yeah.
What's your personal connection except that you watch it or buy a ticket, you know? I don't question someone's, you know, but apparently if your passion is pro style, you know.
By the way, that asshole's Eric Ovechkin.
Yeah, thank you.
I have an answer for you.
That's right. But you know, people can feel entitled to be, you know, to be personally connected to a sports team
yeah.
or to, you know, or to, you know, a fandom of some sort. But apparently, if your geek is poetry, you're somehow snobby. And I'm going, oh, wait, why the fuck is that? Why is that the case? That doesn't make any fucking sense to me at all.
Oh, you're completely right. Fandom is okay at a certain level.
Exactly.
Like you can
right.
learn the nuances of Smash Brothers, but if, you know,
right.
you can name more than the right stuff when it comes to Tom Wolfe books. Like, here's the big homo stamp for your forehead.
Right.
By the way, there is the homo stamp. Please fix it.
There it is right there off to the left. Homo stamp. Yep.
And it makes a gong sound because we are a morning zoo show.
That's right.
Every time I stamp it up there. I mean, that's really all I had. Other than that, I got the results back. Speaking of the shrink not being a help, I got the results back on an IQ test.
Right.
And fuck, am I dumber than
you
I
are,
used to be.
That simply isn't the case.
IQ is way good 13 points lower.
So wait a minute. So how many types of IQ tests are there? Is there just one?
Yeah, the doctor licks his finger and puts it in his rectum.
Well, then, yeah.
I've taken two in my lifetime that were straight up IQ tests.
What's the nature? I've never taken an IQ test, and by the way, I've never taken an IQ test, and I have no plans on finding out who my fucking ancestors were. I don't give a shit. I don't care. And I don't even understand people who do care. But anyway, so
I only did the DNA thing because my mom did.
Right.
And then through me, she could narrow down what the hell my dad was.
Right.
Kind of.
Right.
And so that was interesting. Can't really get away with any like rapes or robberies anymore. Right. You know, I'm on file. But,
right. Right.
You know, I didn't think of that at the time. The IQ test, both of them run about 3 hours in my experience.
Uh-huh.
And it's...
is it the same test? Meaning, like, who administers it? What's the nature of it? I mean...
Both of them were administered by Dennis Rodman.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Yeah. But I mean, is there a governing body that says this is... I'm speaking as a complete idiot where this is concerned.
Yeah.
Novice, you know...
I believe, I mean, as long as they're administered by someone who's been trained to the test, it's all good.
I guess my question is, there's one standard IQ test and that is it.
Mine was slightly different through the years because my first was probably in 89.
Right.
And this one was a couple of weeks back. They it's a lot of like puzzle solving vocab test. I know what you're saying. Is it the same test?
We say, I took an IQ test.
Yeah.
No one says, I took the IQ test.
Yeah.
As if... Because that would intimate that there's just one. There's only one test to take. And
I believe they all consist of similar things, but they are, you know, it's how like there's billiards and then what, snooker or some. There's like eight games you can play on the same damn green felt table, but the balls go in the holes.
Okay.
I think they're all about the same.
Billiards, the balls don't go in the holes.
There you go.
Thank you very much.
And then that one called Woody Peg, where there's just pegs on the table. Exactly. I don't know what it is, but it's Woody Peg. They're similar.
Right.
Like, they test vocab to some degree, explain what this word means. There's a lot of putting puzzles together and stuff like that.
Right.
Under duress. You know, they're car back on your nips.
Wow. That's one draconian IQ test.
It's timed.
Uh-huh.
And the shrink that administered it is friends with my regular shrink.
Right.
And so I didn't see the administering shrink before I saw the friend shrink, my main shrink. And she was crowing. She's like, oh, you're a very smart boy, John. You know, I was like, oh, thank God. I remember this praise.
Right.
I missed second grade. And then I walked into actually getting my full results from the other lady, like all fucking cocky, all plumped up.
Right.
Like, oh, this is going to be good. How much smarter did I get? And fucking was down 13 points, man.
So in the scheme of things, what does 13 points mean? What percentage is that of your intelligence?
I went from 146 to 133.
So what?
I'll tell you, because I used to like hide behind being smart. Like, you have to understand, for all these years that I've not done much with my life, I could think like, well, at least I'm like the super smart locksmith. At least I'm the super smart underachiever. Now I'm not even that.
If you created cards tomorrow, if you created rebranding materials that called yourself the super smart locksmith, your business would fucking go through the roof.
Yeah.
And B, no one would dispute that. No one would say, oh, no, I'm sorry. He's not the super smart locksmith.
I mean, by locksmith standards, yeah, I'm this is my brain searching for super smart guy. I'm Leonardo, Ninja Turtle.
You are the Richard Feynman of locksmiths. Stephen Hawking of locksmith.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, fuck yeah. I'm E equals MC squaring master keying. You know, like I'm doing that shit out the ass. But it was, I don't know, for me, I know it sounds weird, it's a little humbling, but it was kind of freeing at the same time, because it's hard to explain how much of my life was defined and still is by being like, hey, look, everything sucks. By all objective measures, like, I've eaten myself into a not attractive body, and I'm not doing what I want in entertainment, and I don't even know if I want entertainment.
Right.
And God knows the last time I got something without money changing hands. But, you know, like, I'm smart, goddammit. I'm smart.
Right.
And I'm not as smart now.
Who cares?
Well, you know, now it kind of is taking away my armor, and I get to go out there and be like, fuck it. Because that was also presented to me. I randomly enough, in the middle of all my Reddit browsing that I do like 8 hours a day, God damn you, Reddit, there was a fantastic article that explained children who are told they are smart at a young age usually grow up to not do much and not challenge themselves. the thesis being that when you're told you're smart, if you do something you fuck up at, maybe you're not all that smart.
Exactly.
And that praise can be taken away.
Right.
But if you tell someone, and by the way, just that's all I heard as a kid, like you're smart, you're smart. And right. so my brother and I reek of this shit where we'll hunt down the easy stuff. Like, I'm not trying to sell out my brother. He's doing great in life. Like, right. he doesn't live at home. So right there. And he's got abs. So right. there you go. Will's doing all right. But my mom will tell a story where we went out for baseball tryouts and I wasn't keen on it, but I at least did it. He was so freaked out by the prospect of not making it that he just kind of like fucking just crumpled and said, fuck it, and didn't right, try out.
Right.
And I think they put him on a AAA team anyhow. So any kids out there listening, CYA is bluffing. You get out there and you get that goddamn AAA ball. But I identified with that strongly, that, and they were saying people should be praised as children, especially on their hard work.
Mm-hmm.
You should say, hey, you really tried hard at that. That's right. that's awesome, because then people learn what to try.
Right.
As opposed to like, hey, here's a really difficult math problem. Here's 4 plus 4. You know, the smart kid wants to be like 8.
But here's, I mean, I think that what you're doing is drawing a straight line between intelligence
mm-hmm.
and success.
That's not how it works.
It does not work that way.
Oh, God.
Nor does the line between exceptional good looks and success go straight.
Those are the only two things I had going for
me. Nor does the straight line go from talent, either artistic, technological savvy, however you want to define that, to success.
You're just naming the three things I have in spades.
Nor does the line go from horseshoes.
I own some horseshoes too.
to success. There is no straight line. It doesn't work that way. And I think this is something that we were talking about in the last our last podcast together,
mm-hmm.
which is the idea that you know, potential prodigy-esque behavior early leads to this, or that this leads to this. I mean, the and this is something that I was talking about, you know, that literary culture, because that's my bailiwick, is rife with people who, even in their own lifetimes, weren't recognized for the talents that they had. And then there are people who, in their own lifetimes, extraordinary, I mean, outrageous amounts of success, and I'm just staying in the literary realm,
mm-hmm.
who are forgotten these days. Because we simply don't know what posterity is going to, we don't know what they're going
to
do.
I like how you have this massive body of authors that you pull through to reach that conclusion, and I'm just like, I watched Amadeus. That Salieri feller didn't do much.
He didn't do much with that Wolfgang Amadeus guy.
That guy and his wife had boobies.
That's right.
So who was the winner?
That's right, right. Well, for instance, immediately after Shakespeare's death,
mm-hmm.
he was relatively forgotten. Forgotten is not the word, but his star went down for almost a century and a half. In fact, if you'd polled, because they had these things back then,
mm-hmm.
if you'd polled an Elizabethan who was a contemporary of both William Shakespeare and Ben Jonson. Another, you know, Elizabethan playwright, ask him who's the better playwright. It, 9 times out of 10, at least like 10 to 15 years after both their deaths, it would have been Ben Jonson. In fact, the first collected plays were not Shakespeare's, but Ben Jonson's. He was the first, and Shakespeare's star went down for about a century and a half. He was known, but he wasn't prioritized.
I have no fucking clue who Ben Jonson is.
Like, again, exactly.
If you're like,
that's
did Ben Jonson write plays or play for the ABA?
It's both.
Yeah.
Of course, it, Shakespeare's star wasn't resurrected until the early 19th century, like 1820s, 1830s, when the Romantic poets started going, oh my God, this guy Shakespeare. Well, not just the Romantic poets, but other critics started paying attention to what Shakespeare was doing. And Shakespeare is, the cult of Shakespeare is who he is today, primarily because of roots that were planted in like the early 19th century. Between late 17th century on, you wouldn't have gotten that opinion. So literary stars fluctuate.
Yeah.
And careers rise and fall. And we really have no idea why this is. We have no idea what posterity is going to
change. I just need to pay for like 100 years of hosting for this podcast.
That's my point is, IQ test or no, keep doing what you're doing because you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen tomorrow. You have absolutely no idea what posterity is going to privilege regarding your podcast or whatever it is you're working on. No idea, no clue. The only thing you have power over is the notion of getting up every day and doing it. That's it. And if you don't do it, none of that's going to happen. So at the very least, and this is the same thing I said to you last time.
Yeah.
Do it. Just keep doing it. Just keep pressing on.
Keep being that Kyle Reese nutting inside Sarah Connor.
Yes. Just. I don't think Shakespeare could have picked a better metaphor than the one that you just crafted right now.
You know what? Shakespeare, You ended things on such a lovely note, and now I'm just going to give you this dumb tidbit from my life.
Please.
I'm not really a drama kid, which I slightly regret now doing improv because I'm like, shit, I wish I had some acting background.
Right.
But Shakespeare had a profound effect on the trajectory of my life.
How so?
Because I went to the Thomas Jefferson Magnet School in Northern Virginia, where all the like really smart kids go.
Sure.
And wandering the halls, at least back in 95... were barefoot kids wearing like capes, like looking literally like fucking Frodo.
Right.
And shit like that. And it was just the Shakespeare Club that were like outcasts even within the drama
world.
Oh,
God, yeah, yeah.
Just walking around like prithee this, you know, bloweth that. And I was just like, holy shit. Like, I'm a nerd, but God fucking damn. And I was out 9 weeks later back at my paint school. And just any kid that went to that school was like, how did dropping out affect your life? And I'm like, give me till about 50. And then we can rush to some conclusions. So, yeah, that's all I got, man.
Cool.
Yeah. Damn right cool.
Has this been valuable for you?
Always.
It's been fun for you?
Always. No joke. Always.
I think that you and I are the only two people that this discussion will be fun for.
Everyone will hear this, and it's going to be like playing a Judas Priest album backwards. There's going to be like 8 suicides inspired by this. It will be incredible, and I'm psyched. I'm psyched to take that blame. Let's do the outro music. Hold on. Is this it? There we go. Street Fighter 2, kind of your era. Super Nintendo.
Yeah, but I think I told you this. The only video game I've ever played with any continuity, Legend of Zelda, Link to the Past.
There you go. I beat that again recently.
Again?
Yes.
Wow.
Good one.
Yeah.
Great one.
Yep.
Everyone, that was Papa's Basement with Sean Westfall.
Hmm?
As my guest, Sean runs the Unified Scene Theater.
Poorly.
In D.C. You
yes.
give it your all. You run it like I run this podcast. When pressed, you care. Go see shows there. I hope to perform there with him at some point, and maybe we'll do live. If there's any sort of interest in seeing a live Papa's Basement for the D.C. people, we would like to do that.
Yeah.
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 Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Other than that, just find the show on iTunes, Papa's Basement, P-A-P-A apostrophe S, Basement. And, you know, follow it. Twitter at Papa's Basement. Instagram at Papa's Basement. Sean runs. You're just at Sean Westfall as well as at Unified Scene DC, I believe. Are those your...
I'm at Sean Westfall on Twitter and Instagram and at Unified Scene DC on both Twitter and Instagram.
Wow. So. Look who's forgetting his shit now.
Yeah.
Not this brain nun. Not this brain nun at
15 points my ass.
Yeah. All right. We'll do one with you again in a couple weeks.
Sure.
All right.
All right, man.
Always a pleasure.
We're home free. School's out, baby.
Good show.
Nothing to talk about. Nothing to critique. Great show. Great guests tomorrow. You go home, have a glass of wine, whack off. I'll see you tomorrow.
That's the post-show critique?
Yeah. You're the best.
It's my time to go. I successfully burned all my bridges. Nobody loves me, and I don't love nobody.
Then he said penis.
Yeah. Then he said masturbation.
Then he said vagina. That was cool.
Had a mighty hard time, but I'm on my way. Had a mighty hard time, but I'm on my way. It's a mighty hard climb.